Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Congressional Correspondent Cindy Sain. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a Republican from the Midwestern state of Illinois, and we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Kinzinger was reelected last year for another two-year term. He began his career in the House of Representatives in 2011. He serves on the Foreign Affairs and Energy and Commerce Committees. Congressman Kinzinger is also a veteran of Afghan and Iraqi combat operations. He earned the Air Medal six times during his military service, and he continues to serve the United States as a pilot in the Air National Guard. Before being sworn into office, Congressman Kinzinger was named to the House of Representatives Majority Transition Team. He also serves as the Deputy Republican Whip. And at the age of 35, he is one of the youngest members of Congress and was named Time Magazine's Under 40 Rising Stars in American Politics. As he begins a new term in office, while his Republican Party controls both houses of Congress for the first time since 2006, we'll talk with Congressman Kinzinger about a range of critical foreign and domestic policy issues facing the United States. Congressman Adam Kinzinger, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your reelection.
Thanks. It's, we got another couple hard years in front of us, but it's important to be out here. I'm excited to be here.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague Cindy Sain.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of your reelection, Congressman, I wonder if you could tell us how it feels to be back here on the Hill, especially with your party, the Republican Party, in control of both houses of Congress. And what are the priorities, in your view, for the Congress? What are the legislative priorities for the Republicans?
Well, look, it's good to be back. And, you know, as a Republican, it's nice to have the Senate. The thing we need to realize is very complicated debates that happen in the Senate. And you really need 60 votes to pass anything. Republicans have 54 seats. So it's still going to be some difficulty. There's still going to be some back and forth and some tug of war, especially with an administration, a president of a different party. So, you know, that's going to continue for a while. But I think it gives us a real opportunity, and this is something I'm hopeful for, to find some areas of common ground. I mean, our democracy was designed, frankly, to be difficult to work. It was designed to be slow moving. That's what the founding fathers envisioned as probably the right way to do government. We've seen over the last couple hundred years that it seemed to work pretty well. So it's probably going to be a messy couple of years, but we're going to get the big things done that we need to get done. A couple of areas I'm excited about is energy exploration, energy security. That's so important to the world, to Europe. As we talk about things like natural gas exports from the United States, we have a huge oversupply of natural gas, and we'd love to be able to supply that to our allies. Those kinds of things are important. And, of course, manufacturing in our country is very important for getting people back to work and a very important area. And lastly, there's so many issues, but lastly, an important one is trade. We're exploring some very strong trade agreements with the Pacific and the Atlantic. We hope that this is an area that the president and us, frankly, can work together to get done and really help the economies all over the world.
No question about it, especially on trade. I think that may very well be an area of compromise, and we look forward to that. But let me turn to a rather grim incident this week, the horrific murder of the Jordanian pilot by the so-called Islamic State. I'd like to get your reaction to that, especially to what extent it might or might not change the United States' approach vis-a-vis combating the Islamic State, because we note that one of our biggest Arab allies, the UAE, now is in dispute. They're suspending flights to combat the so-called Islamic State in Iraq until the Pentagon improves its search and rescue efforts in northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that concerned you as well.
It does. You know, as a pilot, one of the things, I've flown a number of combat missions in Iraq, and one of the things that we always knew was, you know, if we would go down, within just a few minutes, you'd usually have search and rescue, the people that could come in and save you. You may have to defend your aircraft. You may have to defend yourself, but you can know that within a certain amount of time, they're going to be there to help you. If our pilots are frankly flying without that assurance or are being told that maybe search and rescue is some time away, That's very concerning, and that's something we need to look at. The president, you know, I'm hesitant to criticize him all the time, but I will say this. There's an effort to have a very light footprint in this war. I think it's important that we have the footprint necessary to achieve the mission. We saw what happened with this Jordanian pilot. I watched the video. I made myself watch it. I felt I owed that to this guy. And to see the brutality, I don't even think brutality is the right word. I called it satanic. I mean, it really is just some of the worst things and the worst minds coming together. But hopefully it wakes up the world to the fact that this cancer is not going to stop until it's stopped. There's multiple ways to do it. We've got to educate the next generation. We have to really have moderate Muslims step up and call out this extreme version of their religion. But we also do have to confront this militarily. And this is going to be a big issue that we grapple with in the next, frankly, few months. And I hope the president steps up to what needs to be done, which is, I think it's going to take ultimately embedding special forces soldiers, embedding some ground soldiers on the front lines as we have robust air support.
Congressman, do you think Congress should provide a formal authorization of military force? And what do you think this should include and possibly exclude?
So this is a very complicated debate about the role of Congress versus the role of the president. I think the president has every right to act without Congress, frankly. I think we, in the 2001 use of military force authorization, and also in the 2003 use of force authorization in Iraq, I believe he has the authority under that. I do think it would behoove the president to come to Congress, though. I think he can get a lot of backing. What I want to see, though, is not a use of force agreement that would limit what we can do. You know, the president, I think, wrongfully has said that we will not use ground troops. I think there may be a day when limited ground troops are going to be necessary. But by putting that out there and saying no ground troops can be used, you in essence say, okay, the existence of ISIS is terrible, unless it takes the existence of American ground troops, in which case that's worse than the existence of ISIS. So I think we have to be very careful to not limit not just this president's hands, but I'm afraid that this fight's going to go into the next president of the United States, and I don't want he or she to have to be limited by Congress.
Do you think Congress will take up the issue soon?
I do. I think I'm hearing rumors that the administration's going to present us with a draft use of force authorization, and hopefully that's something that we can come together on and find broad agreement. I think it's an important symbol to the world, and the world needs to understand that America is united in defeating this cancer. We really are. Now, we're going to have some debates in terms of what that looks like, but America's determined that this will not exist.
And in a related question, Congressman Kinzinger, some states in the region, particularly the Sunni states, whether they're in the Gulf or even Turkey, they're all opposed to the so-called Islamic State's barbaric tactics. But there is some ambivalence with respect to this U.S.-led strategy to degrade and destroy ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call it. And that's because they believe that without a concomitant strategy to degrade the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whom many feel have actually fueled the rise of ISIL, the Islamic State, that they will never be defeated. So, of course, we know that the Obama administration has rejected any robust strategy. They are only now beginning to ramp up the training of some 5,000 moderate rebels, but many are saying it's very little too late. What is your position on that?
Well, look, I think there are some out here that wrongfully believe that as bad as Assad is, he's our only hope in Syria. I fully disagree with that. I believe ISIS would not be in existence today if Bashar al-Assad had not brutalized his people. And brutalize is a small word. I mean, you know, killing hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, and frankly, mostly women and children, because in the eyes of Bashar al-Assad, the more innocent people you kill, the more collective pain it puts on the Syrian people. I don't think there's a solution to the ISIS problem in Syria without the toppling of Bashar al-Assad. I wish, if we could go back in time, we would have enforced the red line in Syria. I think that would have done a lot to let Assad know that his days truly are numbered, and it would have hastened the day of a political solution. So, personally, I think a no-fly zone over Syria is important. I think arming and equipping in a robust way the Free Syrian Army and allowing the Turks and moderate regimes and moderate countries in the area to embed with the Free Syrian Army and frankly push against Bashar al-Assad, to push against ISIS-controlled areas and have a plan for the inevitable toppling of Assad. But until we do a no-fly zone, until we make it clear that a post-Syria regime cannot include Bashar al-Assad, I think we're going to continue to have this incubator of ISIS in the Middle East.
Right. Congressman, Next month, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is planning to come and to address a joint meeting of Congress. The visit, as you probably know, has stirred up some controversy because House Speaker Boehner acknowledged that he did not consult with the White House beforehand. And he has asked Netanyahu to speak on a rather sensitive ongoing foreign policy subject, how to deal with Iran and its nuclear program. Plus, the visit comes just 2 weeks before the Israeli election. How do you view this?
Well, look, you know, as an independent branch of government that has equal power as the President of the United States, we have every right to invite foreign leaders to address us. You look at the very important issue of Iran negotiations. So initially we said we have 6 months to deal with it. We extended it 6 months, and then we extended a further 7 months, which wasn't even in the initial deal. It is important for the Congress of the United States to be briefed on the threats in the area. I don't think anybody understands that better than Benjamin Netanyahu. And it's interesting, you look at the domestic politics of it. The president likes to go around Congress on some things, but then when Congress goes around the president, he throws a fit. So I hope that the administration of Barack Obama maybe takes a deep breath and understands this is an opportunity to talk to Benjamin Netanyahu. I get some worrying results about hearing about, you know, folks that worked with Obama meddling in Israeli elections. So it's going to be an interesting process. But again, this is a man that I think understands the Middle East dynamics, and I'm looking forward to hearing from him.
Congressman Kinzinger, let's turn to Ukraine. Now, in light of the increased threat by Russian-backed Ukrainian rebels in eastern Ukraine, there is a major decision for the administration and Congress. Should the United States up its help to Ukraine to include lethal aid? President Obama's choice to become U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said this week that he is actually inclined to support supplying Ukraine with lethal arms to fight these Russian-backed insurgents. What is your position?
I want to be hopeful that the new Secretary of Defense can actually make that happen. I've gotten a little burned out here in hearing the administration making steps to arming the FSA, to arming the Ukrainian rebels or the Ukrainian government, and nothing happens. I think lethal aid must be provided now, and I think it has to be done today. The Ukrainian people were promised, if they gave up their nuclear weapons, the Budapest Agreement, that in fact they would have protection. We see today that they don't have that protection. The president of Ukraine in the past, and of course the Russian military, has let the Ukrainian military basically rot and have equipment that existed when the Soviet Union broke up. I think it's important for us, if Ukraine is not brought into NATO, which I think they should be, but it's important for us to provide them with the weapons they need, at least the defensive weapons they need to protect their own country. I think we ought to be sending trainers in there to work side by side with the Ukrainian military to teach them tactics on defensive areas. Because what you have happening right now in eastern Ukraine is an invasion by the Russians. Now, it depends how you define it, and people can say it's non-state actors, but we all know what it is, and we don't have to play the semantics game. Russia is meddling in eastern Ukraine. So give the Ukrainians the ability to defend themselves, and we'll see where the chips fall. Another important issue, though, is energy security in that region. The Russians really have held Europe hostage to their energy monopoly, and I think it's important for the United States and its allies to help Europe develop their own energy resources, green and gas that's in the ground, as well as exporting natural gas that we have here.
And quickly, before we go to a break, what are the prospects of doing that, especially exporting LNG to Europe in order to wean them from their dependence on Russia? Do you see efforts in that regard?
I do. On the Energy and Commerce Committee, it's an area we're taking up very seriously, but it's going to have a lot of debate. There's some questions and plus some infrastructure issues that have to be developed. It's not going to be in the near term, but hopefully in the medium term we can get this done.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Congressman Adam Kinzinger. He's a Republican from the state of Illinois. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. And check out and like our Facebook fan page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. And here's a shout out to a valued, loyal listener from Ogun State, Nigeria, Wasu Olatunji. Well, now a question from Cindy.
Yes, Congressman, you just recently visited the U.S. base at Guantanamo. And could you tell me what was your main impression after coming back?
Well, let me first off say the base itself is beautiful. It's 45 square miles or something like that. It's a huge base. And detainee operations are just a small part of what that base does. I visited the detainee operations, and I well understand the complicated nature of what's happening with this. If you think back, for instance, to World War II, whenever any soldier was captured under the law of war, they were held indefinitely until the end of that war or until an exchange happened. That's the situation we find ourselves in now. At one point, Guantanamo Bay had up to 700 people in detainee operations. Now we're, I think, at about 120. These are the worst of the worst. And so we have a complicated issue right now. If you let these folks go, we've seen, in fact, that a significant number of them return to the battlefield, or at least return to, in essence, being spiritual leaders now. They're heroes. They survived Guantanamo. And again, it's a difficulty in what we need to do. I believe we need to proceed forward with military tribunals, which is the process for somebody that's a combatant in war. But I think it's important to note this. The United States has extended Geneva Convention protections to these prisoners. They don't deserve Geneva Convention protections by how they were captured, but they get it because America holds itself to a much higher standard. To be eligible for the Geneva Convention, you have to fight in uniform and you have to fight for a state actor. They did neither of those, but we extend these protections anyway. So while it's a very complicated thing, I think these folks should stay in detention until their case is adjudicated or until the war on terror no longer exists.
Some are calling for it to be closed because of what it represents to many around the world. And they say, you know, you could bring them back here. You don't have to let them go. They could be tried in U.S. courts.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two concerns with that. Number one, I would question the premise of saying this is a recruiting tool for terrorists, which I've heard a lot. First off, France did not participate in the Iraq War. I remember hearing many times the Iraq War is the reason for terrorism. France didn't participate, and we see a shooting in the streets of Paris and issues that they have there. We learn that jihadism is not attracted to one certain thing, Guantanamo, whatever these issues are. It's attracted to destroying people that don't believe what they believe. And not even anybody that doesn't believe in Islam, it's their brand of Islam. And that's what we've seen. The other issue is if you bring these folks to the United States, by definition, you have to grant them constitutional protection and legal due process under that constitution. What happens, for instance, if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is brought to the United States, if he is then tried and found innocent? Let's say a technicality, because of a technicality, he's found innocent. What do we do at that point? No, we're prohibited from trying again under double jeopardy. Do we release him to the streets in New York City? Do we deport him somewhere so he can act again? These are very complicated questions that there's no good answers to. But it's important to know that the protection of the United States is number one. And it's also important to know that these folks in custody are treated according to the Geneva Convention and treated well.
Congressman Kinzinger, I'd like to turn now to U.S. policy toward Cuba. As you know, President Obama has initiated a major shift using his executive authority to create diplomatic relations. What is your position on that policy?
You know, this is a tough one for me, and I want to say I'm kind of on the fence on it. I'm cautious. I'm not cautiously optimistic yet. The reason is I've heard the words out of the regime so far saying, well, part of our demands is that the United States give up the base in Guantanamo. We're not going to do that. I don't think Cuba has a right, frankly, for any demands on the United States. In this office, in fact, I've had emissaries from the Cuban government beg me for trade. And I began to wonder, why are they begging for trade? Well, because they feel the grip of their regime, I think, loosening on the people of Cuba. And they want this economic influx so that they can tighten their grip. At the same time, I do understand that Cuba is only 90 miles from the United States. And any way that we can bring Cuba into our sphere is good. I want to push back on the notion that the trade embargo has never worked. Sure, the Castros are still in power, but if you think about it, a number of years ago, Cuba sent troops into South America. They sent them into Angola. They were a big power player on behalf of the Soviet Union at the time. Today, it's a very ineffective military, and they're basically doing everything they can to simply survive in their own country. So I'm cautious on this area. I'm not going to actively oppose opening trade with Cuba, but I'm a little worried about what I see.
Here at home now, Congressman, we have the Department of Homeland Security, which its funding runs out, as you well know, by the end of this month. And there's a lot going on back and forth in the Senate and the House side because funding has been linked to the president's executive action on immigration. What is your position on this?
Well, I didn't think that this was necessarily the best ground to fight in. I voted against one part of this defunding provision, but then voted to fund the Department of Homeland Security at the end of the day. I believe, you know, look, funding runs out at the end of February. We're responsible enough out here that we're not going to let the funding lapse. Now, what's that going to look like? Maybe it's another short-term funding bill as we continue to debate. The real question now is, though, what can the Senate do? And I think we sent our bill over to the Senate. they have to debate and send something back to us. And that's going to be the real question right now. So while there's internal disagreements in terms of the president's executive order and what we believe is an overstep of his authority on the area of immigration, I'm a supporter of immigration reform, by the way. I just thought he did that incorrectly. I think at the end of the day, we'll be responsible and keep the government funded.
Do you think Republicans will be able to find a common position on immigration?
Look, it's tough. It's a very tough issue. In a country where there's only two political parties, you're going to have vast differences in those political parties, and that leads to some complication. I think Republicans all understand that we need to secure our border, and I think we do need to. I've worked the border as a military pilot. I've seen that there's areas of danger, frankly, where drugs come through and everything else. But I think at the end of the day, we've got to understand that you have 12 or 13 million people here illegally, and you're not going to deport them all. So what do we do to bring them out of the shadows? I'm a supporter of that reform, but it's going to take a long process to get there. At the end of the day, this may be something that is solved by whoever the next president of the United States is.
Well, Congressman Kinzinger, let's turn now, speaking of budgetary matters, to this large budget debate. President Obama sent a $4 trillion spending proposal to the Congress that calls for higher taxes on the wealthy in 2016 and an end to these mandated spending cuts, sequester, and more money to help the country's financially strapped middle class. Do you see areas of compromise? A lot of Republicans are saying that it's sort of dead on arrival, so to speak, but others are saying that there are areas of compromise, whether it's the expansion of earned income tax credit for the working poor, a revitalized Pentagon budget, and a surge in spending on infrastructure to repair roads, bridges, and so forth. What are your thoughts?
I think there's areas of common ground in the things that you mentioned. Defense spending, you know, how do we stop the sequestration from occurring? You know, what are ways to at least maybe alleviate that sequestration, which is a terrible way of budgeting? The highway bill, what are we going to do about infrastructure? The disagreements are going to come from the funding of it. I might point out that the president's budget last year was, in many cases, largely the same as what he had this year, and not a single Democrat in the House of Representatives voted for his budget. So is this a serious budget? Probably not. Is this a starting point? Maybe so. Maybe it gives us an opportunity to have a discussion. But let me just say, you know, we've tried the higher taxes on the wealthy. We had that with the fiscal cliff a few years ago, which I voted for. I did raise taxes on people that made over $1 million. Didn't do anything dramatic to close the deficit. We've seen a rapid decline of the deficit, but that's because of some of the spending restraints we've put in. So I think there's areas we may be able to work together. But I would encourage the president that, look, you know, the American people spoke loudly. We won the House. We won the Senate. And he needs to recognize that and find areas where he can work with us to move forward for the American people. And tax reform may be one of those big ones.
And also, as you said earlier, trade.
That's right. Trade also. So trade, if we can do trade and maybe delve into tax reform, I think that would be great for our country.
Speaking of proposals and areas of importance, we note, Congressman Kinzinger, that the Republicans continue to want to repeal President Obama's health care legislation known as Obamacare. What is your view with respect to that? I mean, is it really productive to continue to do that when it does cover so many more Americans than were previously covered, notwithstanding its many faults? What are your thoughts with respect to repealing it consistently, and what about somehow reforming it?
It does have many faults. I think that's important to note. For instance, I have a friend whose deductible went from $1,000 a year to $5,000 a year, which means basically he has to pay for the first $5,000 of his medical procedures. He's going to use that. So it's a $4,000 tax increase on him, even if he may have a subsidy on the monthly payment. There's a lot of flaws to this. I'm for repealing it, but I will say I think we need a replacement plan. It's difficult to do. We saw when the Democrats passed the health care law, they had to put earmarks and things in there to get them to pass that. We don't have earmarks anymore. So a replacement plan that all Republicans can agree on is a difficult point to get to. But this law may fall very quickly in May with a Supreme Court case that's pending. So we're going to take it very seriously to come up with a replacement plan. I think that's going to be important to do. And if that doesn't happen, then I'm a believer in saying we have to fix the parts that don't work. A tax, a significant tax on medical supply companies, there is a significant problem with a 40-hour work week issue that pushes us to a part-time economy. So while it's in effect, I think it's important for us to fix it and make it a better law.
And lastly, Congressman Kinzinger, as a veteran, I'd like to get your view on this movie that's causing quite a stir, not just here in the United States, but around the world, even in Iraq, American Sniper. To what degree do you think it's an honest and accurate portrayal of of the war experience, particularly from the viewpoint of a U.S. soldier?
Well, you know, for me, it was one of the most realistic movies I've seen in terms of taking me back to what Iraq was like. Obviously, Iraq was not a fun time. We understand that. We were fighting, in many cases, some very bad people as Al-Qaeda in Iraq was being built up and everything else. And at the end of the day, when I left Iraq in 2009, we had brought the Iraqi people, even though it was difficult to get there, some freedom, and we saw a war that was won. I disagree that we pulled out troops in 2011. I think that was a huge mistake. But snipers, frankly, are probably our most precise weapon. You think about artillery shells, you think about 500-pound bombs. In many cases, you can see collateral damage that happens in rare cases there. A sniper trains his sight on one bad person and takes out that threat. It's the most precise weapon we have. It's frankly the most humane weapon that we have in the military. And snipers save a lot of American and allied lives every day. So I'm proud of our snipers in the military, and I think the movie is an accurate depiction of the sacrifice that they make on behalf of their brothers and sisters in combat.
And one more question on Iraq. Many are saying that U.S.-led efforts to try to degrade ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, are working, but the political efforts to bring reconciliation among Sunnis and Shiite-led government and its militias and so forth are really lagging behind.
Sure. The military seems to be out progressing the politics in some cases, but it's a very complicated political situation. It's much better than it was under al-Maliki. I've talked to Kurdish leaders there. I was in Iraq, in fact, 4 months ago, and they say that it's a much better relationship, although there's still strains. We're going to understand that's going to take a long time. But at the end of the day, the destruction of ISIS has got to be our big priority. And again, we can push them out of Iraq eventually, but ISIS is not going anywhere until the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the incubator of ISIS in Syria, is destroyed, and people need to understand that.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger is a Republican from the Midwestern state of Illinois. Congressman Kinzinger, thank you so much for
you
your
bet.
Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.